From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's show, who's got the best earning power in Michigan?
Michigan is sort of typical in that the gap between the top and the middle has gone way up, but the gap between the middle and the bottom has not.
Plus, is there any hope Detroit's mayor and city council can stop fighting and start working together to keep the city from going broke?
If the mayor and council can't work together on something as simple as finding a lawyer, like, how are they going to work together on big reform issues?
Plus, maybe you suspected this. It's true. Using that cell phone is as contagious as a virus.
So when someone pulls out their phone, it's a cue. Oh, you know, I should check my messages.
We've got those stories and much more for you on today's Stateside. But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. A controversial land sale has been approved by Detroit City Council, but the deal doesn't mean new factories or buildings. Instead, think tens of thousands of trees. We'll have that story. And we'll get an update on safety concerns at the Palisades Nuclear Power Plant in southwest Michigan. But first, income disparity has been a huge issue in our state's economy. That was the case even before Governor Rick Snyder signed right-to-work measures into law yesterday. Supporters of those laws believe they'll bring new jobs into a state still plagued by high unemployment. Opponents say those jobs won't provide a livable wage. They're afraid the gap between rich and poor will continue to widen. That got us thinking about income disparity and how it's playing out right now in Michigan. So we called up Charlie Ballard, professor of economics at Michigan State University, and we asked, just what are we talking about when we say the words income disparity?
Well, there's a lot of emphasis in the public discussion about the unemployment rate or the level of income or the inflation rate, but I'm talking here about what's the gap between those at the top and those at the middle and those at the bottom in terms of how much their household income is. And a big story that has received a lot of attention at the national level is that the gap has widened a whole lot in the last 35 years or so. What I'm focusing on in some research with my colleague Paul Menchik is how has that varied from state to state. Michigan is sort of typical in that the gap between the top and the middle has gone way up, but the gap between the middle and the bottom has not. In other words, it has been a mediocre time for the lower income and the middle class, but a very good time in the last 35 years or so for those at the top.
And I would suspect statistics like that are being looked at very closely by the newly reelected president as he talks about the tax cuts on the wealthy Americans.
I think so. I mean, basically, my sense of the election, if you could summarize the difference between the two candidates in one sentence, it was that after we've had this very large increase in income inequality, President Obama was bothered by that more than Governor Romney. And that shows up in a variety of ways, but one of them is the president would have somewhat higher tax rates on high-income individuals.
Let's look at your study more closely. So just to recap, you're saying basically things have not changed in the gap much between the middle-class, medium-class level earners and the lower, but a large opening up with upper class. Why so?
I think there are a bunch of reasons, but the one that I think is most important is that those at the top tend to be college educated. Those in the middle and at the bottom tend not to have college education, or they might have an associate's degree, but many are just have a high school diploma. And a very big story is that the earnings of those with a college education have done very well. And the earnings of those with only a high school diploma, and especially if you have less than that, if you're a high school dropout, those earnings have not done well at all, really since the 1970s. And that's the biggest story. Back in the 50s and 60s in Michigan, we had a less well-educated population than the national average, but it didn't hurt us because the fabulous success of the auto industry was such that people with only a high school diploma could get upper middle class wages and benefits. But that world has eroded very badly. And so those folks haven't done well. But the people at the top have done very well.
Where do we fit as far as the state of Michigan with, because you studied the country, so where does Michigan fit in?
In a lot of ways, we're sort of a middle-of-the-pack state. Take the ratio of the household income for the person at the 90th percentile. That's the household that has more income than 90% of the households. That's an upper middle class.
Okay.
Compare that with the household income for the household that's at the 10th percentile, which is in the poverty range. That ratio increased by more than 20% in Michigan, sort of similar to the U.S. average. The U.S. average went up a little bit more than Michigan, not much. But that, if you break that down further and you compare the 90th percentile with the middle, the median, the 50th percentile, mm-hmm. that's where all the action was. The increase between top and middle explains all of the difference in the increase between top and bottom in Michigan and in the United States as a whole. The middle just didn't move relative to the bottom.
So middle's that 50th percent, they're just kind of plugging along.
And they've had very modest improvements in their financial situation. And in fact, we are looking at the period going all the way back to the mid-70s.
Hmm.
If you compare today's median household with the median household back 40 years ago, you're likely to be comparing a two-earner household with a one-earner household. You know, it was really possible back in the old days for usually a husband, not always, but usually the husband, to be the only earner in the household and still have a pretty good livelihood. The middle class has struggled. There's just no question about it.
And as far as different states, you found some interesting findings with a couple of states, New York and Massachusetts, that really saw a lot of change. Talk about that.
The biggest increases in inequality were on the East Coast, and though that's the most highly educated region of the country, they have degrees of college attainment that are substantially higher than we have in Michigan. We're not the bottom. The bottom is West Virginia and Mississippi in terms of educational attainment, but Michigan is sort of below the pack, in fact, a little bit below average in education. By contrast, some of the southern states were the most unequal. They didn't increase their inequality as much. In fact, some places didn't increase inequality at all. Georgia is one for which our data indicate their income disparity is almost exactly the same now as it was 40 years ago.
And what does that mean?
Well, that means that the bottom relative to the top actually had some decent income growth. We're doing further investigation about why that might be, but certainly one part of it is, remember back in the 70s, that was a time when racial discrimination in the South was still very strong.
Yes.
Racial discrimination is still there, but it appears not to be as severe as it was.
Hmm.
And that may have helped blacks in the South, whereas blacks relative to whites in Michigan have actually lost ground.
Because of what you've talked about, the changes in wage earning for people who worked in factories and
exactly.
the blue-collar sector.
The blacks who, you know, 100 years ago, Michigan was almost all white.
Mm-hmm.
The migration from the South to the North happened in the middle decades of the 20th century. And why did it happen? Both blacks and whites moved here from Alabama and Tennessee to get those factory jobs.
That's right.
And then as that factory-based, that manufacturing-based economy has struggled, those folks have struggled.
So taking all of this data, and there's a lot of it in your study, what's someone listening to us talking today, what should they take away from that, Charlie?
Well, I think as far as Michigan goes, we are somewhat typical in that we have experienced a very large increase in income inequality. That's something that concerns me. Let me go back further. In
mm-hmm.
the middle of the 20th century, education was increasing faster than technology, and that was good for people in the middle and at the bottom. In the last 40 years, technology has been racing ahead, and that has really benefited those at the top, as automation means that instead of building cars with the person fastening the same four bolts 107 mm-hmm. times an hour, now that's done by a robot. And if you're going to have that good job, you've got to be able to program the computer and fix the robot. So the skill requirements have gone up, but our educational and skill attainment has not gone up as fast. And so I say we got to do something about the skills, especially of those who are not completing high school or who are just completing high school, and we really need to do more about that if we're going to have any chance of turning this around.
What would that say to people in Lansing, our policymakers, our governor, the people who really control our policies? What should they be hearing from what you're saying?
Well, from what I'm saying, if this concerns them as much as it concerns me, uh-huh. and frankly, I think it concerns some folks in Lansing, and it doesn't concern other folks. But if you're concerned about it, you don't want to sacrifice education upon the altar of tax cuts. Mm-hmm. Our taxes, state and local, as a percentage of our economy, are much, much lower than they were in the 70s. And we've increased our spending on health care and prisons. Well, it's got to come out of somewhere. And that means we've decreased our investment in education, and especially in higher education. I think that's been a mistake, but it has predictably, it has contributed to this increase in income inequality. The people who it really makes a difference for are the middle class and lower income families who, even though they get financial aid, they still are going to end up with a lot of student loan debt. And many of these folks, I think, they look at it and they may just decide, wow, I can't afford college. But that, of course, will just continue the trend. And that will lock them into being in the lower part of the income distribution, which I think is very unfortunate.
Always great talking with you, Charlie. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Dr. Charlie Ballard, Director of the State of the State Survey and a Professor of Economics at Michigan State University. Still to come, we've all seen this, a group of people out together, maybe at a restaurant or out shopping, and instead of interacting with each other, they're all staring down at their smartphones. We'll speak with one researcher who says cell phone use is actually contagious. That's in 15 minutes here on Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Throughout the week on Michigan Radio, we've heard the voices of those speaking out for and against right to work. Yesterday on the program, we heard from UAW President Bob King. Today, we're talking with Tim Boss, a driving force in getting right to work passed in Michigan. Tim is neither a business owner nor a lawmaker. In fact, he was a union member for 17 years. He grew up in a union family, the son of an auto worker. He is a staunch supporter of right to work and believes that it means good things ahead for Michigan. Tim, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, Tim, give us your thoughts about really being on the front lines of history yesterday, part of the day that made history not only in Michigan but across America.
Well, I was very pleased to see what happened. When I got involved in this on April 14th of last year with about 35 other people from around the state, this was just a dream. And it's been a dream of many, many people, and we didn't really know if we would ever see it happen. But it was something that we felt very strongly about, and it didn't have anything to do with being against unions. We love unions, and we've all been in a situation, or most of us at least, have been in a situation where we work for a company that was a crappy company. Mm-hmm. And since you spend most of your waking hours working, if you're in an environment where you have a lousy boss or a lousy company taking advantage of you or treating you poorly, having someone to go to bat for you is really, really important. And we cherish that. We want to make sure that always stays healthy and available. On the other hand, we think that it has been very detrimental to the union cause and to workers in general by being forced to financially support, and when you think about it, a third party that is allowed to siphon off part of your earnings just in order for you to have the ability to continue working.
And now, the unions will say if the workers aren't happy, they can vote to decertify 30%.
Yes,
so respond to that.
And that's true. The problem is that you have – this whole thing is all about power and money. And like I talked about, spending most of your waking hours in your place of employment, there's a tremendous amount of coercion, intimidation, things of that nature that goes on so that you are scared to death of going against the unions and letting it be known.
Now, you keep saying you. Has this happened to you?
Yes.
All right. So this is an experience.
Yes.
This was happening.
Yeah.
Was it a gradual path you traveled to go from being a union guy to one who realized that right to work needed to happen, in your view?
Yeah. As you said, I grew up in a UAW family.
Mm.
And I've had many conversations with my dad. He retired from General Motors as a test driver at the proving grounds in Milford. And I didn't get into the UAW until of 1978. And it was apparent immediately that things had changed considerably. They were much, much more politically motivated. They were much more militant. Because I asked him about, May Day protests and things of that nature, and it wasn't nearly as political. And so I am the type of person, because my dad was pretty much like a drill sergeant in mm-hmm. the way he raised me, work ethic is something that I have, a very strong work ethic. And I'm smart enough to know that if the company that's paying me isn't making a profit, I'm going to lose my job. And I take pride in my work. I take pride in craftsmanship and doing it right the first time. And many, many, many times as an apprentice pipe fitter in an apprentice program, mm-hmm. I was told to slow down. You're walking too fast. I was told to quit working so fast. And the object was, or the way it was laid out was, if you can go ahead and do the work of two men, then there's no longer the need for two men. And that translates to a loss of power or a loss of money for the union leadership. And that didn't set real well with me. And because of that, I was kind of chastised on a regular basis. I've had my cars keyed. I've come out to, after working a 12-hour shift, come out and find I got a flat tire, mm-hmm. things of that nature. And this isn't all people, and it's not all unions. It's just some people that have this desire to impose their will on others.
So now that Michigan is a right-to-work state,
yes.
What do you hope, what do you feel personally, because you've been part of the fight, as you mm-hmm. say, since the beginning of last year. What do you think will come to Michigan because of all of this? What's your hope that will be the real benefits to Michigan for being now a right-to-work state?
You'll see manufacturers from around the world come into Michigan. They'll open their doors, and pretty quickly what will end up happening is there will be more jobs available than people. And so what ends up happening to try to counter that problem is manufacturers will offer elevated wages to attract workers. In addition to that, they'll have elevated wages to protect the workers that they have because they don't want to lose them. In addition to that, you'll have all kinds of support services companies that will come in to support the companies that do come here. You'll have companies like Boeing, which came into Michigan and seriously considered buying the Willow Run bomber plant, where they know that they don't have to worry about some strike or something that will put them out of business.
But let me ask you, and I know you've heard this in the arguments and mm-hmm. the debates, that the studies that show that right-to-work states trail non-right-to-work states in terms of worker incomes and the kind of jobs that are available. How do you answer that?
I'm glad you asked me that. You have to understand that everything is relative. And what I mean is if you're, say, here in southeastern Michigan or in lower Michigan and you're making $40,000 or $45,000 a year, you're able to make payments. You're not worried about missing a payment. You can make car repairs, or if the furnace goes out, you have that income and you do okay. You're not getting rich, but you're not anywhere near starvation or poverty. If you take that very same income of $40,000 or $45,000 a year and you transplant that income into a higher cost of living area, say Chicago, Los Angeles, San Francisco, or New York City, you're on poverty levels. And the point I'm trying to make is that different areas of the country have lower or higher costs of living. The studies that you're referring to actually were pointed out by the Commerce Department's Bureau of Labor Statistics. And what they did was they analyzed all of the different states in the country and they said, okay, the current 23 right-to-work states, how much is the net annual income? In other words, after you pay taxes and everything else, how much do you have left over? And in that study that was released last year, they found that the national average was, I forget what the number was, but the right-to-work state's annual net income for workers was about $1,000, almost $1,000 higher than the national average, and it was over $2,000 a year higher than forest union states. That being said, if you're making $15 an hour here and at the end of your paycheck you've only got, say, $300 left at the end of the month, but you're making $12 an hour down south in a right-to-work state, but you've got $700 left at the end of the month, are you making less money? You sure are.
Tim Boss, Michigan Freedom to Work. Thanks for speaking with us today on Stateside.
My pleasure.
Again, we are getting a lot of different views on our right to work here on Michigan Radio. You can find all of our coverage online. Just go to michiganradio.org. Now, along with Tim Boss, thousands and thousands of people packed into and around the state capitol yesterday as the legislature took up its final votes on right to work. And it is a very good guess many of them had cell phones, smartphones, tablets, using them to check in with one another and get the latest news. With that in mind, it can be really hard to think back to those not-too-distant days when we did not have cell phones. Just look around you the next time you're at a coffee shop or restaurant. Chances are good you'll see a group of people together. But are they talking to each other? Maybe. But chances are also good they've all got their eyes on their phones. One wonders, can't they just put the smartphones away and talk? University of Michigan professor Dan Kruger says perhaps not. He and his research partner, Professor Julie Finkel, studied students on campus as they interacted with each other and their smartphones. He joins us now in the studio. So, Dan, you discovered cell phone use is literally contagious like a virus?
Right. So when people are together in a social space and one person picks theirs up, then their companions are more likely to use theirs as well.
Which explains when you see the groups together and everybody's tapping away and texting and Instagramming and all of that. Is this almost like a virus?
Right. It seems like a feedback loop, and it happens quite frequently. You know, we think that some of this might be people are thinking, oh, you know, I had to check if I got that email or that message. So when someone pulls out their phone, it's a cue. You know, it's a primer. It's like, oh, you know, I should check my messages. But this is happening so often, you know, sometimes, you know, several times in just 5 minutes that it can't be just, oh, I really need to check if I had that meal now. We think it's really related to social attention. So imagine that you have attention as a limited resource and you're dividing it between those people in your real space and those people in your virtual networks.
So you have X amount of attention. There it is. You have that amount.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm with a group of three friends. So then as soon as I see you pick up your phone, that all of a sudden I've lost some of your attention?
Right, right. You can think of it as a conversation that they're in and you're excluded from, not necessarily intentionally. You know, it's not as strong as, you know, ostracizing you, but it's something that you can't participate in. And that's aversive to people. You know, it's an aversive experience. It's sort of like, oh, no, they're paying attention to this other person. Then what does that mean about me? You know, I'm not socially included. So it's being socially included in the conversation. And when you're socially excluded, people seem to react to that, both thinking, oh, you know, that's rude. But they also might reach out to their own social networks so that they feel socially included as well.
So you're going to have your conversation. So I'm going to divert my attention from you and start having my conversation that you're not a part of.
Right, right. I'm going to have mine. And also for all the people around, you know, if you have one person who's always on their phone and checking their phone, well, who am I to be just standing here and waiting for this person to be done with the other conversation? So it's also demonstrating to those other people around that, hey, I have friends too. You know, look, we're both socially involved.
So I see this possibility of all of these subsets of conversations happening via text. So what does that say about the face-to-face interaction that is supposed to be the basis of human communication?
Well, it can really detract from it. When everyone is in their own little world, then the social interactions that we have in real space can suffer. So this is something that I hope people become more and more aware of, and we become smart with our smartphones and manage them appropriately. You know, so for example, you wouldn't want a situation where you had a television in every room and it was constantly on and everyone was constantly watching the TV rather than, you know, engaging in conversations with those around them. And this is, I mean, still fairly new technology. You know, we've had it for a decade or so. But I think that we're still learning how to really use it effectively and appropriately. I mean, people are still talking on their phones, you know, with the phone in their hand while they're driving down the highway.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think we still have some learning to do.
Is this something you've observed in adults, like post-college age, as well as – I know you were studying college students. Do you feel this is something that mom and dad are doing as well?
You know, I think it can happen in older adults to some extent, although most of the people that we observed, you know, it's around a university campus, so they're probably around the typical student age. And it just seems to be my impression that – you know, younger adults, college students, high school students seem to be on their smartphones the most. And, you know, it might just be that they grew up with them. You know, this was just part of their lives when growing up. You know, they've always had access to them, you know, in the same way that, you know, people's parents and grandparents are still getting used to email.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so they use it and will send emails back and forth, but they're not on email, you know, every hour like you or I might be.
But and this is something I'm suspecting was not as much of a problem when all we did on those cell phones was talk. It's the invention of the smartphones and all the ways we can play, Instagram and Twitter and Facebook and mm-hmm. Texting obviously was the first thing outside of talking. So this, I suspect, am I right that you wouldn't be observing this as much if it was a matter of just talking on the phones?
Yeah, probably not. I mean, I think that the added dimensions that you get from the smartphones bringing additional opportunities, you know, so people could be checking their Facebook updates and looking at the pictures that their friends are sending them. And in a way that they might not perceive this as bad as, oh, if they're actually talking to someone, they might not realize mm-hmm. that it's not just the noises that you make, you know, when you're talking to another person and how distracting that can be. It really is about the attention that you're giving to your electronic world and taking away from those people that you're with in person.
So take this forward down the road a few years when these students who are learning to interact or not, as the case may be, they're running the world. They're the politicians, they're the business leaders, they're the attorneys, they're the doctors. What do you worry about as far as their ability to communicate?
Well, I'm hoping that there's more attention paid to interpersonal communication skills in person. This is a broader concern that people have about, you know, people are growing up, they're spending so much of their social times in electronic environments and online that they're not really getting the experiences and building the skills of what it means to have in-person conversations and discussions. And maybe some of these in-person interactions are beginning to mimic, you know, the really telegraphed speech and quick conversations that they're getting in the text and not having, you know, a full conversation.
Yes, with all the nuances.
Right, with all the nuances, if everything has to be condensed into a 150-character burst, you know, it's not going to be as effective, you know, or as meaningful.
So what should we do about this?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we have to learn how to use this technology in a way that doesn't interfere with the other aspects of our life. You know, just like other technologies that came before it, I don't think we can take it away, you know, put the genie back in the bottle. And it really is a useful and effective ways of communication. You know, you can message people from all over the world and get information quickly. But I think that people should pay more attention to how this interacts with the real life social world. And maybe by giving these people a perspective, saying, well, now how do you feel in this situation? You know, oh, yeah, that person is rude. Oh, I wish they wouldn't do that. Mm-hmm. Well, do you realize that, you know, you're doing it too, and this gets to be this feedback loop where it's really detracting from your quality of interaction. And then maybe they would get an idea. And maybe to more closely regulate our own use of the technology. So figure out when is an appropriate time to use it, when is not. So if you're at the movie theater, you know, or in church or out at a fancy dinner, you know, maybe you should not, you know, not just turn your phone to buzz, but turn it off so that you're not distracted at all.
Professor Dan Kruger from the University of Michigan School of Public Health and the Institute for Social Research. Thanks for sharing your insights with us today on Stateside.
Thank you for your interest.
A controversial land sale was approved by Detroit City Council yesterday. But the deal doesn't mean new factories. It doesn't mean new buildings. Instead, think tens of thousands of trees. We'll find out more in 15 minutes. This is Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Let's turn now to what's happening with the Palisades nuclear plant in southwest Michigan. Company officials who run the plant say they're trying to improve the safety culture among workers. But as Michigan Radio's Lindsay Smith reports, Entergy Corporation admits the plant still has a long way to go to reach operating excellence.
A number of people at a meeting last night demanded federal nuclear regulators shut Palisades down after a number of water leaks this year. Kevin Flynn lives just a couple hundred yards away from the plant in Covert Township.
They said the leak came from an area that they, you know, aren't used to. And I think we're in an area of uncharted water with an old plant that's embrittled. They don't know where the leaks are going to come from. They don't know where the next problem will occur, and that's the problem.
Regulators say they are keeping a close eye on the plant next year, even though the plant's safety rating was recently upgraded. They made a rare request for extra inspections to ensure lingering equipment problems are resolved. In South Haven, I'm Lindsay Smith, Michigan Radio News.
Right to work may be grabbing the lion's share of headlines and attention in recent days. But there are many other challenges facing our state and leaders, including the very future of the city of Detroit. And as we've heard time and again on Stateside, the economic tailspin and the threat of bankruptcy matters for the entire state of Michigan. So while most eyes have been turned to the dramatic scenes of the past week in Lansing, what's been happening at Detroit City Hall? Here's Governor Snyder this morning talking about Detroit City leaders.
They're moving some things forward, but I would say there's a long list of things that they also need to get done very real time here. They need to keep going and keep the pace of what they're doing now and do many more things in the next couple weeks or so.
For an update, we turn now to Detroit Free Press editorial writer Nancy Kaffer. Nancy, we know State Treasurer Andy Dillon has certainly been front and center at City Hall in recent weeks. What's the latest?
Well, as you know, City of Detroit has been running low on cash. It needed to draw about $30 million from an escrow account in which the state is holding the proceeds of a bond sale that happened over the summer. And in order to get that $30 million draw on that escrow account, the City Council had to pass five key contracts. This happened yesterday. All five passed, most of them with a relatively tight margin. So they're going to get the $30 million that will stop Payless Paydays and a short-term cash crisis.
Yeah, for now.
For now. But that's the big question. Is a morning or a day of cooperation where things are able to move forward and progress is made and requirements are satisfied, is that signaling any kind of long-term attitude shift between the mayor and the council that would indicate that the city is any better situated to handle its deep, deep financial problems.
And we already saw there was a lot of trouble, particularly over the contract that the mayor wanted to engage Miller Canfield Law Firm, and that just raised all kinds of hackles on council. So it did not pass easily, did it?
No, and it was really needlessly controversial. The fact is, the mayor and the head of the city's law department are at odds with each other.
Crystal Crittenden.
Crystal Crittenden, correct. Over the summer, she took a lot of efforts to try to scuttle the consent agreement between the city and the state that has been sort of a guiding document to try to keep the city out of emergency management or bankruptcy. If she had been successful, it would have had really bad consequences for the city in terms of the city's ability to operate in the financial market. It did have bad consequences for the city because the city's bond rating was downgraded in part because of the divisiveness between the Corporation Council and her actions. So the mayor can't use Crystal Crittenden as attorney because she's shown that she's not really accountable to him. And because of the way the Detroit City's charter is constructed and because of a charter amendment that passed in November, she is not really accountable to him or to the council.
So he can't fire her, because I hear that from people. Why doesn't he just get rid of her?
To fire Crystal Crittenden requires a supermajority council vote and the mayor. The mayor needs to bring it to council. The council has to approve it by a supermajority. So it's a pretty tough standard
to
meet. And it makes her... she gives her a very disproportionate amount of power in this issue. So the mayor needed attorneys.
Yeah.
He wanted to use the law firm Miller Canfield, and that really shouldn't have been a big deal. Part of council's objection, or some members of council's objection, was that Miller Canfield had been involved in the writing of Public Act 4, the emergency manager law that was repealed last month. And I would say, like, find a law firm with a municipal practice that didn't have some involvement in PA4.
Well, that's what I wondered. And even council said there are a lot of good law firms in the city of Detroit. Why did he have to land on the one that would cause all the brouhaha?
But why does it matter? The guy should be able to pick the lawyer that's going to represent his administration. And it was really kind of a tempest in a teapot that it became such a controversial contract. This one should have been a no-brainer. But more importantly, this is symbolically, it's even more important than the mayor's ability to pick his own law firm. Because the issue is, if the mayor and council can't work together on something as simple as finding a lawyer, like, how are they going to work together on big reform issues? That's a real dysfunctional relationship, and there's been flaws on both sides. The mayor doesn't bring council supporting documentation in a timely fashion. He comes down to council with just giving them very short notice to vote on very important stuff. Council has been sometimes not really willing to play ball with things that obviously needed to happen.
Kind of petulant at times.
Yeah. I mean, but it's not a good relationship.
No.
And I don't know how they move forward with the big fixes for Detroit if they can't get along. And I don't know how much one morning of getting along changes that big picture.
And you know, Nancy, we're talking right now with Nancy Caffer, who's Detroit Free Press editorial writer, who's been following for quite a long time the unraveling of the finances of the city of Detroit. And Nancy, we hear Governor Snyder say that he is studying municipal bankruptcy, but it is a last resort. Mayor Bing and council members like Gary Brown and Charles Pugh, they all say we don't want bankruptcy. But as you say, this seems to be so incredibly deeply dysfunctional. Is that why they just cannot get together to reverse this bloodbath of money?
Well, no one wants bankruptcy. And, you know, that's not what's on the table right now. It's whether or not there'll be an emergency manager in Detroit. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, bankruptcy would have bad, it would be bad. There's the first thing that happens in a municipal bankruptcy is that creditors try to show that that whatever entity is filing for bankruptcy isn't eligible. Even if you win, it takes a long time, it costs a lot of money, and that's just to file. You know, not to mention the consequences that a bankruptcy filing could have on credit ratings of government entities around the state. You know, how sympathetic would a bankruptcy court be to residents? These are all things that we really don't know. And it's not a good scenario.
Look ahead for us, Nancy. As we say, you've been following this story for a long, long time. And it seems the proverbial can keeps getting kicked down the road. Things don't get done. They can't reach consensus. Then, oh, they kind of do, like we saw with these contracts. Mm-hmm. And the city still limps along. At what point do you think that they cannot kick that can along any further?
Well, it seems like we're coming up to that point, but it seemed like that before. It was, if you'll recall, pretty much a year ago that the governor first sent a financial review team into Detroit that sort of kicked off the process that led to the consent agreement. And I think at that time, a lot of us thought, well, this is it. The shoe has dropped. They're going to stop kicking the can and things are going to change. Well, they got the consent agreement, which isn't working. And here we are a year later, another review team coming in. to reassess the city's finances with an emergency manager looming. But in my opinion, the city's financial situation really needs to be assessed in a very clear-eyed way, and hopefully the governor and the treasurer and the mayor and council will all come to some conclusion that leads to some positive changes for Detroit.
And we will be keeping in touch with you, Detroit Free Press editorial writer Nancy Kaffer. Thanks for your perspectives today on Stateside.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
And as we just talked about with Nancy, city leaders in Detroit continue to have a tough, lengthy battle over how to keep the city from avoiding a state takeover. But City Council did vote yesterday to approve a controversial land sale. As Michigan Radio's Sarah Hewlett reports, the deal won't mean new houses or buildings. Instead, it counts on tens of thousands of trees to set a new course for one blighted corner of the city.
We're actually going to start this story a little ways north of the area in question. Mike Score is opening a gate that leads to a demonstration area, basically a small-scale version of what Hance Farms wants to do a few miles away.
The brush is gone from the long side of the road.
Score is the president of Hance Farms.
And out in this open area here, you can see there are still some houses. But the vacant space that used to be covered with tall vegetation and brush and garbage is cleaned.
Cleaned up, and you have to look closely. They're pretty small, planted with neat rows of hardwood trees.
So we planted 900 oak trees, and then we came back in and planted about 300 sugar maples in between the oaks, and we're managing this as a tree planting. This is the concept, and we'd like to do this on a larger scale.
We drive a few miles south to Detroit's Lower East Side. The Hance Woodlands Project promises to clean up about 140 acres here and put it back on the tax rolls. The lots are scattered across about a square mile that includes some denser neighborhoods on the western half, but that quickly empties out as you drive further east. We stop at the corner of St. Paul and Crane Streets. There are no houses on any of the four corners or for long stretches down any of the blocks.
I've lived a lot of places, and this part of the city feels like a very small town in a rural area.
The agreement with the city will require Hance Farms to tear down 50 homes in the next 2 years. That's about half the abandoned homes in the area now. The company will also have to haul away any trash, and there's a lot of that. It's also agreed to mow the grass at least every 3 weeks. But before you get all warm-hearted about the prospect of a cleaner, brighter future for this little corner of Detroit, you should know there are lots of people who question this deal.
What I see right now is kind of a repeat of history.
Linda Bain is one of dozens of people who spoke out against the project at a public hearing this week.
If you are a second, third, or fourth generation of being a black Detroit person, I'm going to say to each one of you, remember Black Bottom. Remember Black Bottom. Remember Black Bottom. Remember Black Bottom.
Black Bottom was a thriving black business district that was demolished in the 1960s in the name of urban renewal. Critics look at John Hance, a white, wealthy businessman who's getting the land at $300 a lot, and they see a speculator getting a sweetheart deal from a city desperate for money and development ideas. Back at the demonstration site, Mike Score says the idea that his boss wants to sit on the land for a few years, then develop it to make a quick profit, just does not track with market realities. And Score says it doesn't track with Hance's personal objectives either. Hance lives in the neighborhood next to the project site. And Score says Hance thinks it could help convince some of his neighbors to stay.
And if nothing gets done, if everything in the city looks like the area across the street where the blighted houses are still located, the people who live here will want to leave, but nobody will buy their houses, and they'll feel trapped. And I don't think that is a mindset that nurtures stronger communities.
The Hance Woodlands Project will purchase 1,500 city lots. That still leaves about 58,000 parcels the city owns but doesn't have the resources to manage. Score says that leaves a lot of opportunities for other people with different ideas about how to best use Detroit's most abundant resource. For Stateside, I'm Sarah Hewlett.
cultural celebration on Woodward Avenue in Detroit. After a six-month, $12 million renovation, the Detroit Historical Museum has reopened its doors. It's the first facelift for the museum since the 1960s. And there's something else new that's going on that'll make it easier for everyone to visit. Bob Berry is the executive director of the Detroit Historical Society. Welcome to Stateside, Bob.
Thank you, Cynthia. Glad to be here.
So for anyone who has been to the museum in the past, give them an idea of what's new and how the museum has changed.
Literally every square inch of the museum has been touched in some way. But one of the things we were very careful about is to be sure that the things that people really remembered, really were very fond of, like the Streets of Old Detroit and the Body Drop and the Motor City exhibit, that we didn't change them too much because those were some of the attractions that people, even before the renovation, came back year after year to see.
That's good to know, because that was always my favorite thing to do as a kid. Just loved it.
Yeah, that's kind of the signature experience that everyone remembers. And we've added a couple of new enhancements to it that I think you'll like, but I'll let you come down and see
I'm
what
going
those are.
To. Talk about the Kid Rock Music Lab. That is not your grandfather's Detroit Historical Museum.
No, that's for sure. The Music Lab is really a lot of fun. You go through some glass doors, and there's a concert stage going, and you see Bob Seger or Kid Rock or someone else performing on the stage in a very large-scale format. But you can also test your music trivia. Pick your decade of the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s to 2000s, and just see how good your musical trivia skills are. Or you can move over to a mixing area where you can mix your own music by adding the right amount of drums and percussion and different sounds to create your own song. So there's a lot of interactivity there in addition to some great artifacts. And, you know, at the end of the day, what museums can do is bring those artifacts out and bring them to life for the visitor.
Bob, I want to ask you, as executive director of the Detroit Historical Society, this is obviously something very, very dear to your heart. As you walk through the Detroit Historical Museum, tell us, what is your favorite exhibit? Is there one thing that just lights you up whenever you see it?
I guess I kind of err on the side of the Streets of Old Detroit are certainly a favorite and an experience that, in a feeling, you can't really have anywhere else. But if I look at the new areas, what lights you up, it's got to be the Tiger Stadium letters. You know, Tiger Stadium was a beloved, iconic place for so many reasons in this community for so long. And we were very pleased that when the stadium was demolished, we were able to get the letters. And as part of the Alice E. Gallery of Culture, we have the original Tiger Stadium letters restored and re-illuminated just as they looked on Michigan Avenue for all those decades. And when you walk into that room and you see that, it's really an experience that really takes a lot of people aback, including myself.
Bob Berry is executive director of the Detroit Historical Museum, celebrating the grand reopening of the Detroit Historical Museum after a six-month, $12 million renovation, and free for all to come and enjoy. Bob, thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you.
And here at Stateside, we always want to hear from you. Is there a museum in Michigan you think we should all know about? Maybe a person or a story that you want to hear more about? Let us know. You can find us online at michiganradio.org. And we're on Facebook. Just search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty, and that is C-A-N-T-Y. And we're on Twitter at Stateside Radio. I also want to let you know about a special event Michigan Radio and Stateside are hosting. On Friday morning, I hope you'll join me for coffee and conversation. I'd love to meet you and hear about the stories that you want told on Stateside. We'll be right here at Michigan Radio. That's Friday morning this week from 7:30 a.m. until 9 a.m. at our Ann Arbor studios. You can get all the directions and all the information. Just go to the events page at our website, michiganradio.org. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Stateside is engineered by Mark Brush. Contributors are Allie Billings, Ellen Cortezoa, Emily Fox, Cameron Stewart, and Mercedes Mejia. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you at 3 tomorrow.